Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome. This is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased and excited. My favorite thing on Bookworm is when I'm talking to a first novelist, and it's someone whose work I have not previously known. My guest on the show today is Elizabeth Wetmore, Beth Wetmore. Her book is called Valentine. It's published by Harper, and it's a novel. Beth Wetmore is 53 years old, and this is her first book. She's published many short stories in many of the best literary journals, the Kenyon Review, the Colorado Review, but this is her first time in hardcover. Tell me, Beth, what did it feel like to finally see the book in hardcover?
Well, it's all been a little unreal, honestly. I worked on the book for a long time and I was ready to, you know, have the editor sort of wrestle it out of my hands. Honestly, I think if she hadn't wrestled it out of my hands, I'd probably still be tinkering with it, to tell you the truth. And even now I occasionally spot a sentence or a paragraph that I think, oh, I'd like to have a do-over on that. But on the whole, it's been wonderful and surprising to me. I think I expected the book to come out very quietly. And so it's been marvelous to see how many people have reacted to it in such a positive way and how meaningful it's been to some people.
Yes, the book has made its debut as number two when it came out on the New York Times bestseller list. And it's set where Beth was born, in West Texas, in Odessa. Now, if you're me, you think, Odessa, that's near where my family come from in Russia. This is Odessa in West Texas. How does it get its name?
Well, it depends on who you ask. That part of Texas was settled pretty late in the early 1880s. And depending on what piece of local lore you believe, it was named Odessa in part because of the sort of grasslands that people said resembled the Odessa in Ukraine. And that's really been the most sort of certain story I've heard.
Now, West Texas is known for its oil economy. I'm sure most of my listeners will know this, but what is an oil patch?
Well, so Odessa is in the Permian Basin, which is about 86,000 square miles in size. And of course, West Texas in general is even more vast, right, than the Permian Basin. And it's an oil and natural gas rich region of the country. I read recently, actually, that until the pandemic hit, it was on pace to outpace Saudi Arabia for the biggest production in the world in the next 5 years. That slowed down and been derailed a little bit by the pandemic, of course. But an oil patch is, you know, a part of the world where that is the single economy, oil and natural gas. It's not a particularly pretty place in the world, at least not by most people's standards. I think it's beautiful. There's no other way to make a living out there other than working in oil and natural gas. And Odessa, where I grew up, differs slightly from its sort of sister city of Midland, which is about 23 miles away, in the sense that Odessa is a very working class town. Most of the people who live and work in Odessa do the blue collar work of the oil patch. So they work as roughnecks and pipe haulers and fitters and water haulers. And that's still, even today, a pretty male dominated industry. Women in that part of the world tend to work and support roles as bartenders and waitresses, preschool teachers, that sort of thing. So that's where I grew up.
Most of the writing centered around Odessa is writing about these men who come jobless from all over the country to work and drink in Odessa. They have nothing else to do. They have nowhere to go. They get drunk, a lot of roughnecks, and therefore a lot of mistreatment of women. And your novel, Valentine, is about a woman, her mother is Mexican, who is raped there on the oil patch. They don't want to call it rape. They say rape is an ugly word. And that's what this book, in a sense, is about, that we have to start to be willing to use the ugly words that women have been having to use for generation after generation, while the men have been taking refuge in the difficulty of living in a place by themselves without their women. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, Gloria is, she's Mexican American. She was born in Odessa. She's 14 years old when this crime happens. So she's a child, and there is very much there was then and even today there's very much a sense of Southern conservatism, I guess, that really. That wants to steer clear of sort of the uglier parts of life, right? And as a kid growing up in Odessa, in the 70s, I mean, I was about the same age as the little girls on Larkspur Lane, were about the same age as I was in 1976. I was old enough to be aware of a lot of young men coming in from all over the country. And at that particular time, there were a lot of young men who had just returned in the last few years from the Vietnam War and gone back to their home states and discovered that there were no jobs. So they poured in from all over the country to make a quick buck in the oil patch, and a young man without a college degree and with very few skills could make a good living in the oil patch for just as long as the oil boom lasted. Now, of course, once the bust hit, that was all over, right? And they left town. But I grew up in a family of people who had already put down some roots there and were staying for the long haul. So although most of the men in my family worked in the oil patch at one time or another, my father was lucky in the sense that he was able to land, when he returned from the war, he was able to land a job at the petrochemical plant where he worked for the next 35 years of his life. And that was somewhat safer, although still quite dangerous and more stable than the life of a roughneck.
Well, I am talking to Elizabeth Wetmore, Beth Wetmore, about her magnificent, really, first novel, Valentine, which begins on Valentine's Day, the day after Valentine's Day in 1976. And we watch a young woman virtually crawling out of a car in which the man next to her, who has hit her, who has ruptured her spleen, who has hurt her, she staggers out of the car and makes her way across desert, across the hot, sticky, unbearable grasslands with bits of glass that she has to walk through. There are cuts all over her by the time she reaches the nearest ranch house. There's a woman there who, against everyone's better judgment, opens the door and sees this child who has been hurt. And this woman asks the crucial question, what if this were my child? Would I close the door? Would I say go away? No, I have a child, and I have got to open the door. And the whole book follows from that dire act of opening the door in a community that wants to say, oh, she's just a Mexican-American. There are all kinds of names that we find in the book that we hope aren't used anymore. But there she is, and she has to be taken right to the hospital. In the meantime, the boy who has, yes, let's use the ugly word rape, the boy who has raped her, Dale Strickland, has driven in his truck to the house and says, give me my girlfriend. He denies there's been anything but a lover's quarrel. And eventually, the ambulance comes, and behind the ambulance, the sheriff. And the sheriff says, wipe that grin off your face. You're in trouble, boy. I don't care if you're the son of a preacher. What you've done will land you in terrible, terrible trouble. Now, had you seen anything like this, Beth?
Well, I was a nosy little girl who eavesdropped a lot on my mother and her girlfriends when they were sitting on the back porch after supper. And so I overheard a lot as a little girl. But, you know, as a little girl, I mean, there was so much that I wasn't privy to. And of course, when I was growing up in Odessa, it was also a deeply segregated and deeply racist town. And some of those problems linger to this day. And so I wasn't, you know, a girl like Glory would not have been, you know, in my radar, in my world, right? I grew up on an entirely white street in a deeply segregated town. So it wasn't until I started working on the book and I started going through old newspaper archives that I came to realize how common violence was, particularly in the midst of an oil boom, and how specific much of that violence was against women and girls. And then, of course, you know, the second thing I realized was that as difficult as this world was for white women and girls, it was so much more difficult for Latinas who were living in town, and people like Glory and her mother and her uncle Victor, who is a veteran, you know, who's returned from the war where he served his country and immediately encounters, you know, the worst kind of racism from his old boss, right? And so for me, I was not aware as a little girl, you know, of how dangerous Odessa really was for women and girls. But I was aware, you know, that when an oil boom came to town, suddenly it became very important to our mothers and our fathers that we stay in groups, right? That we not go bicycling off by ourselves, that we always be with someone. And I was aware, you know, of the kind of, and this is the 70s, so I was very much aware of the kind of never, ever talk to a strange man, not anywhere, right? Not in the grocery store, not at the 7-Eleven, you know, nowhere. So those were all, you know, things that I was somewhat aware of. But of course, it wasn't until I was a grown woman and able to go back and study my hometown as a woman that I really realized how terribly dangerous that place really was.
This first novel, Valentine, is narrated nearly entirely by women. Six women, seven women. We hear their voices. We hear their sorrow. We hear their shock and shame. And it's an extraordinary book because voice has been given the central role in the book. Yes, it's a fascinating plot, nearly a thriller, but what we're hearing are women's voices. Now tell me, how did you learn to capture such individual speakers?
Well, I guess I should say that when I began the book, I had men's voices in there as well. Several of them, as a matter of fact. John Ledbetter had a chapter. Corrine's sections were, in early drafts, were entirely narrated by her husband, Potter, actually. And I handed those sections over to her several drafts into the book. And part of that was that it was difficult for me to imagine writing a book set in that time and that place in the oil patch without having male voices. Writing about the economy was incredibly important to me, and I could not figure out a way to write about that economy and not include male voices, because it is so male dominated even now. Little by little, draft by draft, I came to realize that I wanted badly to bring these women's and girls' voices to the book and to let the book be theirs. Part of that was some of my own memories from my own reading life. When I was a young woman, I went through a period of time where I really fell in love with the you know, American Western. And, you know, so Larry McMurtry and Elmer Kelton and Charles Portis. One of the things I noticed in my reading of all of those guys, you know, I loved the characters, but I didn't see a lot of women and girls' voices in those books. And so there came a point in my own writing when it became incredibly important to me to really hand this book over to the women and girls. In terms of how I get the different voices, I mean, I worked on the book for a very long time, you know, about 14 years on and off. And of course, I took long breaks mm-hmm. from it to earn a living and raise my son. And I took long breaks from it, honestly, because I sometimes lost my nerve. Writing is very hard for me. I work very slowly. And it was incredibly important to me to get these women and girls' stories right. In early drafts, I drew deeply on my memories of the women and girls I knew growing up. And then as these things go, you know, draft by draft, it becomes more and more fictionalized, more deeply imagined. And that was the case with Valentine.
Well, I have to tell you, well, from the very first chapter, you had me hooked. The second chapter had me hearing voices. And the third chapter, the sound of Corrine and her special kind of sarcasm. She had been a school teacher. She'd quit to have her child, a child named Ellen. She discovered that she did not enjoy staying at home, as many women don't, being a mother. And she requested of her husband that she be allowed to go back and teach. She has the most unusual, sarcastic, knowledgeable voice. She's a terrific and terrifically funny character. How long did it take you to find the sound that she makes?
You know, I love Corrine, and I'm going to tell you, she was the biggest surprise of the book to me. I think I mentioned just a minute ago that initially all of her sections were narrated from her husband's, Potter's, point of view. And I imagined her as a very, mm-hmm. very minor character, kind of a cranky neighbor lady who would pop across the street to deliver a pithy one-liner and maybe a piece of news that would further my plot. I did not imagine her as a major character at all. And so when I made the decision that the book was going to be narrated entirely by voices of women and girls, I had to get rid of Potter, and I started to wonder about Corrine then and handing some of his sections over to her. And once I did that, she really, really rose up off the page and became a major character in the book. And to me, one of my favorites. And part of that, I think, is, again, you know, when you work on a book for 14 years, the world changes and you change, right? And I think that as time passed, I was able to understand her sorrow and her bitterness and her rage, you know, in ways that I couldn't when I first began the book. So I really fell in love with her, and I'm so happy. I guess there's always a surprise in every book you write for the writer, you know, at least one, probably a lot more. And for me, the biggest joy and the biggest surprise of Valentine was that Corrine became a major character.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Elizabeth Wetmore, Beth Wetmore, who, at the age of 52, published her debut novel, Valentine. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Wetmore about her debut novel, Valentine, a window into the beauty and hope in the depths of darkness and fear in 1970s West Texas. Now, I'm dazzled by how many directions this book takes me in. We not only meet the woman who has taken in the hurt child, we meet the church ladies, and they are people who say to Mary Rose, who's taken in the child, that the word rape itself is ugly. She attends a woman's council meeting, and they follow her into the bathroom to ask her not to come to meetings until she's more herself, and certainly not to use that ugly word anymore. To what extent has the church become a place where this kind of violence has been sanctioned?
I think there's a deep history in white Southern Protestantism, you know, of justifying sort of violence against women, racism. And I was also very interested in the way that, you know, a young woman, because Mary Rose is very young, you know, she's 26 years old, and she has a 9-year-old daughter and another one on the way, right? And a lot of the young women in this book are very young mothers. You know, these are women who have their first babies at 15, 16 years old, who are married by the time they're, you know, they're before they're out of high school. And she's been subject to the same social ills and the same, you know, racist beliefs and the same sexist beliefs as anyone else in that town. But that moment, right? That moment when there's a knock on the door and she opens the door and sees, you know, an injured child, right, on her front porch, that moment shocks her conscience and it changes things for her.
Yes.
And she's no longer able to fit in, right? And it comes at great cost to her. And, you know, in a lot of ways, of all the characters in Valentine, the one I'm most concerned about, worried about when the book ends is Mary Rose, right? Because, you know, she's not able to fit in anymore. And that question, of course, of what you do when a stranger comes to your door asking for help is one that I'm very interested in. In a lot of ways, I think it's the most important question any of us ever ask or answers, whether it's a girl who's been, you know, has just survived this horrific attack, you know, or it's a family of migrant workers who show up at the door asking for, you know, help from a different country.
Well, as we say now, she's woken. Mm-hmm. She's woken by what she sees. And the fact that in order to get away from the thing that she saw at that ranch house, she moves to town. When she moves to town, her phone never stops ringing. It's men and women calling her and saying, are you going to testify against a preacher's son? Are you going to call him a racist? This is entirely unacceptable. Dale Strickland was just doing what was natural for him to do.
There's very much a sense of, she got into the car willingly, right? And there's a sense of no one in the book, including Mary Rose to some degree, is really able to see or understand Glory or her family. You know, Mary Rose is still subject to the mores of the time and the place and her own upbringing. She does have a kind of awakening early in the book, but she's still, to some degree, unable to really ever fully see Glory. And that was important to me in this book. One of the things you'll notice is that after that initial encounter on Mary Rose's front porch, Mary Rose and Glory Ramirez are never again in a scene together. Glory's path does not cross the path of the other characters. She goes back to her community and her uncle, who tries to sort of help her heal through this. And to me, that felt right and true to the time and the place and the characters. I knew very early in the process that Glory was not going to get any sort of justice from the legal system. I'm very interested in how women and girls without a lot of resources or education or power find a way to sort of take care of themselves and their daughters and each other. But all of it felt to me like it had to also be true within the context of the time and the place. And so it was very important to me to keep Glory's world somewhat separate from Mary Rose's world and Corrine's and Deborah Ann's and all the white characters in the book.
It's done brilliantly, and we're going to talk more about how it was done next week. I've been talking with Elizabeth Wetmore, Beth Wetmore, author of Valentine, published by Harper. Thank you, Elizabeth, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my show collaborators, Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, production manager J.C. Swadek, technical director Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when you will hear how a woman can publish a novel at the age of 52. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Elizabeth Wetmore returns.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.